Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Sorry to let you down. Enjoy the show. Everybody, welcome to AnCast. Justin's here.
Hey, everyone.
And it is yet another meeting. It's been almost a year of the Super Nerds. So joining us is from Otaku USA and the Anime World Order podcast, it's Daryl Surratt.
Drummers in the house.
And from Anime News Network, Mike Toole.
Hey, guys. Yeah, it has been almost 10 months, right?
Yeah, about...
Well, that's a good sign. It means you've been able to line up guests.
Now, these are some of our most popular shows. I just let it go for a little while this time. You know, let it build up the anticipation so that when a new one comes out, people, you know, they treasure it more, right?
It's they usually can't miss us if we don't go away.
Yeah, it's usually around twice a year, right? Seems about right.
Yeah. So it's been a little while. Obviously, we're not going to go over the last 10 months, but usually we start things out with a little, you know, what you've been watching. I watched a couple of things, but let's start with let's go ahead and get Justin out of the way because I know he's a little under the weather tonight. So,
yeah, I am. All right, let's see. So I've been watching. Actually, I've been dog fooding, as it were. So, you know, in the last couple months, I got these two new giant box sets that I worked on from NIS, both Cardcaptor Sakura and Toradora. I'm like, you know, I actually didn't get to watch Toradora when doing it. I was running around, you know, making sure things weren't terrible. Mm-hmm. So I've actually started going back and watching it, and I forgot what a cute, fun little show that is.
A lot of people like it.
Yep, and then I've been alternating that and anyone remember, the name is killing me right now.
I guess you don't remember.
It's sitting right over there. I'm really stupid today. Give me a break. It's that Akitaro Daichi show that just made no sense and was like a short comedy series that went on for like 50
minutes.
Yes, Sexy Commando.
Sexy Commando? Oh, it was a fantastic show. I loved that back in the old fan sub days.
It is a lot of fun, and I never actually got through more than a few episodes of it, so I'm just kind of slowly chugging my way through it. You have to take it in little gulps.
Yeah, that's how a lot of that spastic Akitaro Daichi comedy stuff was. You watch maybe one a day or one a week, and you're good.
Sexy Commando Masaru is one of those shows that, yeah, one episode will just make you feel tired.
Right. More than that, and you just want to lose your mind.
What stuns me about that show is that that's based on a Shonen Jump manga.
That doesn't surprise me. Why is that surprising?
I don't know. I don't know. I feel like Jump's kind of settled into a formula in a lot of ways. Just from the 90s, before that formula was fully realized.
Yeah.
Right, and before they had to appeal to girls, too, therefore everyone was Bishonen.
Mm-hmm. You don't think Masaru is a dashing hero? With the pants zipping
down.
He's
so handsome. I'd kill for that hair.
And the duck? The crotch duck?
Correct.
Yeah, who can argue with the crotch duck?
I saw, like, three episodes of that fan subbed, like, back in the day. I wonder if I would find it funny now. I'm going to go ahead and guess no.
I have to admit, at some points, I just... You know how when you're a teenager and you're into like some really like insanely spastic stupid comedy and your dad walks into the room?
Yeah.
And he just kind of has this baffled stare on his face where he kind of has that deer in headlights thing going on and then he just kind of shakes his head and walks out.
Yeah, I'll admit, I
felt like that a couple times watching the show.
That was
my dad's reaction to The Adventures of Pete and Pete.
Dad doesn't have a sense of humor, does he?
Well, it's just it's a show that kind of overwhelms an older person when you're watching it back, 20 some years ago, I guess now.
Yeah, my dad had that reaction to Kadocha, actually.
I think everyone had that reaction to Kadocha. That wasn't an otaku, at least.
Kadocha really lost its steam once it went away from that, though.
Yep, sure did.
Totally.
Oh, my God,
totally.
Yeah.
Once it turned into a preteen soap opera, oh, God.
Which wasn't that far into the show, actually.
Yeah, it's like 20
episodes or so. Once Zanjiro leaves, then it's downhill from there.
Anyway, okay, so Sexy Commando. Is that that's a discotheque release?
No, no one ever released that. I'm falling back into really, really, really old fan subs.
Right.
they're still AVI files, Zach.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's great, though. I love digging
Someone's
up some of those
it.
Old files. Well, you know, it's like you find an old DVD-R of something that just no one ever even thought of licensing it. And you're like, hey, I remember this.
How do you think I write my column?
Yeah, right, exactly. Okay, is that it?
For anime, live action-wise, I've just been binging Orange is the New Black.
Oh, I still haven't started watching that.
You know, I have such a love-hate relationship with that show.
I think everyone does. Like, it's always a conditional recommendation.
Yeah, it's so freaking cheesy and, like, so television-y.
Well, it is a TV show.
Yeah, but, you know, Mad Men, Breaking Bad, you know, the good TV shows on cable that we've all loved, even House of Cards isn't that television-y the way it's shot and edited. This is like watching a sitcom from the mid-80s.
You're right that House of Cards is a good-looking show, but, like, writing quality-wise...
Oh, yeah, it's really, really dopey.
It's Netflix doesn't have anything like AMC or anything like that. Like, they want that stuff, but I don't know why the writing is always, like, falling down with their stuff. Like, that's everything I've heard about Orange is the New Black. Like, what you just mentioned, I haven't heard anyone say that, but I have heard them constantly complain about the writing. So, like...
Yeah...
Like, this show thinks it's much better than it actually is.
It's just entertaining and has likable characters, and that does go a long way.
Yeah. I think that's kind of what the audience for TV is looking for more than anything, is that likable character they can, really latch onto, and they don't really care so much what the story is as long as they're on screen. It's Moe, only American style.
Moe, except lesbians in jail.
That's you should write that script, Moe American style. There you go.
Yeah. I can picture it. Complete with the cheesy 70s opening from Love American Style.
Maybe the existing movie could just be retitled. Okay, Mike, let's go on to you.
Well, since the World Cup, I've just kind of been playing catch up. Like, this is gonna disappoint some people, but I haven't really watched much of the current season of anime. I just finished watching Chaika, and that's been a fun watch so far. That's kind of the best and the worst of, like, JRPG elements.
Right.
Where it's like, you know, you've got these really fun characters and kind of a weird setting, but, you know, there's no clear villain. The world isn't really well explained. So, but I enjoyed the first half of that, and I'm looking forward to the second half. You know, I went to the theater and saw K Missing Kings after watching the TV series. That is all style and no substance, but it is still pretty enjoyable. It's been a good year for anime at the movies, man. I saw the Dragon Ball Z movie, too. You know, I saw Tiger and Bunny a couple of months ago. It's been nice to have something to go to every month or two, rather than maybe once or twice a year.
How did you like Dragon Ball?
I thought that was an absolute hoot. I'm a big fan of the old school, you know, Dragon Ball weird-ass toilet humor. So that appealed to me immensely. And, I thought it was a fun time. It's one of those, you know, you go to it with a rowdy group of people who were just, you know, there to laugh and have fun at the movies, and it's a great experience. It's one of those, I look at that, you know, it made $2.5 million. That's like, I think, a third of what Dragon Ball Evolution made in the U.S. If they actually released that thing with an ad campaign on like 200 or 300 screens, I think it would have done pretty decently.
I think it did pretty decently. It was weird. So, like, I didn't know they were doing this. But, like, so up the street from me is an independently run megaplex. It's got, like, 25 screens in it. It's not owned by a chain. And they were just showing it there as a regular movie. In fact, I think it's still playing, like, 10 or 12 times a day on two screens.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised to see that. And then when I pointed that out on Twitter, a bunch of people were like, oh, yeah, the indie megaplex near me is doing that, too. So I guess a bunch of theaters were just running it as a normal movie, not these like one night only or three nights only special events. So I think that's maybe how they got to that $2.5 million number, Is that plenty of theaters were just showing it at a regular movie?
It could be. My local Regal cinemas were the ones who picked it up here, and they had three showings in that additional in that initial week. All three of those sold out way ahead of time, and when they added extra showings the following week, that's when I got to see it. And even at the added showings, there were like, you know, 30 or 40 other people there with me.
Well, you know.
You know, it's like, I'd liken it to, you know, after that terrible live-action movie, it's like going from the live-action Street Fighter movie to when the animated movie came out on video. And, you know, the live-action film bombed in theaters, that animated movie sold like hotcakes, because that's what people wanted. Same thing with the Dragon Ball Z film.
Yeah, I was...
I bought the UK Blu-ray of that. It looks very nice.
Same.
I was a little surprised that when I saw the runtime for the theatrical, it's an hour and 15 minutes, and the director's cut's like a half hour longer or something like that, but that's the one they're putting on Blu-ray. So I guess that was their strategy.
Sure. I mean, hey, man, that Blu-ray is going to be everywhere you look for like $15, and if there's that much new footage and stuff on it, I'll jump for that.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's not the greatest movie you've ever seen, but it's a fun experience. I mean, I dig the whole... I think Dragon Ball is at its best when it's like this weird-ass family comedy with fighting, where it's like, you know, Goku is the dumb dad.
Right, it's like a Kevin James movie. Let's get a reboot of live-action Dragon Ball starring Kevin James. Let's do that.
Yeah. You know, I binge-watched Knights of Sidonia while I was at the World Cup in Brazil. That's fabulous. I thought, it kind of plays it safe with some of its elements, but I thought it was really cool. And live-action-wise, I haven't picked up anything new. You know, I watched the hell out of Game of Thrones when it was on, but since then, you know, True Detective is still in my queue, which should tell you how far behind I am.
Yeah, wow. Okay, awesome. All right, Daryl, I guess that's you.
All right, well, I'm pretty caught up with the current season. I'm watching, Space Dandy. It's great. JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, Stardust Crusaders, Tokyo Ghoul. I also recommend that one so far. Terror and Resonance, I mean, I'm watching it. I'm hoping it stays good. This is one of those things where its quality depends entirely on how it ends. A show like that, it's a hell of a ride, but if it drops the ball at the ending, as a lot of shows like that tend to do, you'll be like, oh man, I wasted my time. You know, it's more than past the halfway point, so it should be over within the next month. And by then, you'll know, should I watch this, yes or no? That's the up or down on that one. Live action-wise, I'm really into a J-drama currently airing called Blue Blazes, Aoi Hono. It's a live-action version of the manga by the same name. It's sort of a fictionalized take on the author of Blazing Transfer Student and his days in college and his antagonistic run-ins with the people who had later found Gainax. So it's filled to the brim with all sorts of 80s anime pop culture references.
That's where all those screenshots have been coming from. I was wondering what that was.
Oh, yeah. It's Kazuhiko Shimamoto is the original author of the manga, and I guess the main character is sort of a fictionalized version of him named Moira Hono, hence the name Aoi Hono, Blue Blazes. And so he's really, like, self-absorbed and, like, grossly overestimating his capability, and then, you know, the Gainax guys do something that just sort of move him to the core, blow him away, and he gets really, fixated on it. It's a great show. It's being fan-subbed by some guys, people who do, like, the tokusatsu-type stuff. Definitely a lot of fun. Maybe 5 or 6 episodes of that are out now. I recommend it.
Cool.
So, yeah, not too much point in talking about, you know, JoJo's and Space Dandy, since they're only, like, you know, the two top hot shows out right now. I don't really need to sell anyone on those.
Well, not necessarily selling anyone on anything, but how do you feel about the second season of Space Dandy so far?
A lot more experimental than the first season, which I like. I like that now it's just sort of carte blanche of, hey, here's a talented person, writer, director, etc. Make an episode and do whatever you want. And I like that it's sort of become this sort of crazy playground to just go wild. That's sort of what I was sort of hoping for with when they announced, you know, the sheer breadth of how many people they got together for it. And so I like that they're going for it, and I like that people are staying with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been enjoying it. I think this one's a little bit, just by the nature of it being more experimental, there are fewer episodes overall where I walk away from it going, that was great. But I never regret the experience of watching a Space Dandy. Like, there's always going to be something interesting.
It definitely works best when maybe if you let a couple episodes accumulate and then watch through a few, yeah, just so you can see the variety.
I've been doing that, yeah. Like the last one I saw was the Munagi episode with the giant moonfish that they were trying to catch. So I'm like two behind, I think. but before that was that high school episode that everyone was talking about for a little while, which, admittedly, I had some, like, it was nice that they tried that, but boy, they didn't have the money for it. They did not have the money to animate a musical. They just didn't. And it's all there on screen. Like, the cut budget alone is like, well, there's got to be a lot of awkward pauses in here because they have to hold these shots for quite a while. The still shots, they have to hold them for a while. And it kind of interrupted the flow of everything. And it was a little awkward, but I still enjoyed it. But it was still like, man, this is an example of reach exceeding grasp. but that's fine, you know. I'll take a really, really interesting, maybe not so much of a success over bland old normal shit. So, yeah. So, yeah.
Cool.
Anything else?
All right. No, I think that's that about covers it.
All right. So the thing I watched was Space Pirate Captain Harlock.
Oh, boy.
I
reviewed that one.
The Shinji Aramaki movie that Toei spent $30 million on.
It's definitely a Shinji Aramaki CG anime film, and it's definitely a Captain Harlock film for all the pros and cons those both entail.
Hey, man, I'm waiting for the dub by the great Stephen Foster before I watch that.
I believe it's already there.
Is it already there?
The one on Netflix is dubbed.
It was not at launch. It was only available in Japanese and Spanish for the first week.
Well, I watched it in Japanese.
They put it up in English, and you can turn on the subtitles for the full How They Lied-o-vision, and boy, how they lied.
Oh, man, I'm doing that like tonight then.
Yeah, I watched it in Japanese, but yeah, you're right.
What'd you think of it, Zach?
It's a Shinji Aramaki movie. At first I was like, you know, this looks pretty good. And like, you know, I saw Appleseed Alpha, and you know, I think technology's kind of caught up to let him make these kinds of movies, and they don't look awful anymore. They don't look great, but they don't look terrible. So what it looked like to me was Shinji Aramaki directing Final Fantasy cutscenes with a Leiji Matsumoto flavor packet sort of dusted across the top. You know, they couldn't get too Matsumoto-y with the character designs just because the design sensibility of the film really wouldn't allow it, I didn't think. I didn't really think the style of the CG, the way they designed those, you know, sort of photoreal characters, it just doesn't really allow for Matsumoto's design sensibilities to come through very well. So, like, the alien girl, yeah, that was, like, the most Matsumoto-y thing in there. But the rest of it, it was a Shinji Aramaki movie. Like, down to every design detail was totally Aramaki.
Yeah, I regret that he didn't take my advice to heart when I interviewed him a few years ago, asking and sort of demanding a transforming motorcycle worked into the film. He sort of laughed and said, oh, well, maybe. But, you know, come on, Shinji Aramaki, that's what you're there for. You gotta provide. You gotta deliver.
The question I wanted to ask is, okay, this new Captain Harlock movie, is it better or worse than the Shinji Aramaki Starship Troopers movie?
I think it's better than that movie, but again, this is like, you know, you have to really be willing to accept, okay, this is the conventions, like the Captain Harlock storyline are a little, you know, ridiculous and overwrought. You know, Captain Harlock definitely has the space battles down, but, you know, Zach is definitely correct. It's still got the same issues that so many of these 3D CG anime movies have with regards to weight, with regards to the action choreography, with regards to, you know, the character designs and the movement and facial animation and such. You know, there's something very sterile and kind of like there's the humanity is sort of lost in a lot of them in a ways.
I thought it looked better than average for one of these. I'm comparing it only to, like, the Appleseed movies and other, you know, fully CG Japanese productions. I thought it looked a little bit better than those. Definitely, like, the color design in the movie, I think, was pretty good. I liked the way the movie looked. and the space battles were done pretty well, but this story was kind of bullshit, and the twists and turns kind of made you wonder why you cared about what was happening at all. It was, yeah, I don't know.
There's so much bad Harlock, though, that it's not even the worst Captain Harlock.
No. Like, I wasn't particularly bored by it, so that's good. And I kind of liked the way it looked. I thought the story was bullshit. I mean, if you're curious, go check it out. I watched it because we're interviewing Aramaki at Japan Expo this weekend, and I had to write some questions. So now that I've seen it and Appleseed Alpha, I can be like, hey, so what's up? I wonder if that thing was seen as an embarrassment, because it cost $30 million and it only grossed 17 worldwide. Wow. Which is a big ouch.
So your leading question in the interview will be, Mr. Aramaki, you have failed. Can you please explain why?
Do you still
That's
have
your
a
question
career?
For Tamino also, Mike.
That's my question for everyone.
Are you being allowed to succeed in spite of your failure? No. I wonder, like, if Toei just home video sales couldn't possibly make that. But I also wanted to know, maybe you guys know more about this than I do, what would compel Toei to this is the second most expensive movie in their production history. What would compel them to spend that much money on a Harlock movie?
It's big in France, Albator and the like. Captain Harlock's got a following outside of Japan. I'm sure that must have been, like, they were thinking, like, this will do well in Europe and maybe South America.
Yeah, the France gross was actually higher than the Japan gross, so that bore out. But I'm just curious, because it doesn't seem like that's a recipe for success. I thought for a second, were they looking at that live action Yamato and saying, "Oh, there's a thirst for this material, a big budget version of this material."
That was my thought exactly, Zach. They were looking at live action Yamato 2199, and saying, "Well, you know, we could, you know, we've got another masterwork by the same creative team, so let's milk that." It didn't work out.
Still, I couldn't believe that budget. And I'm like, man, like, Beardo Let Matsumoto fans are going to recoup your $30 million? I don't think so. Like, is this a family film? Because it seemed really obtuse for a family film. I don't know.
It isn't even, like, released for sale here in the U.S. I mean, the only way to watch it is Netflix. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
Yep.
Did they just sell it directly to Netflix?
I have no idea.
It's been happening more and more lately.
Yeah, I talked to one of Netflix's content guys, and they licensed it directly. If there's home video, it's going to be handled by someone else. But yeah, they just went straight to Toei and got it from them.
Oh. I'm sure they shopped it around, and, you know, the various anime distributors said thanks, but no thanks, since it's kind of a recurring thing that, the anime publishers here, you know, as far as selling media, have a little bit of a harder time releasing something that's not like a TV show or a larger franchise sort of thing.
I mean, I would be surprised if Funimation didn't take a crack at it, because according to them, that live action Yamato is one of their top sellers.
Not if they don't get a cut of online rights.
That you're absolutely right. That's true. I don't know.
Well, if that live-action Yamato movie is doing that well for them, would they hurry the hell up and release Yamato Resurrection, please?
I don't think that's how it works.
Yeah, I know.
It's
one of those materials problems, I'm sure.
Yeah, really. So I saw that, and writing up those interview questions, and I wanted to briefly mention, so we are on the cusp of launching our daily streaming reviews initiative, which, if people haven't heard of this, basically we're doing what the AV Club does with television. So every day on the site you will see reviews of last night's new episodes. We just hired like 8 writers, and we're getting ready to get this off the ground sometime in the next 2 weeks. They're going to do catch-up, so there's going to be one article covering all the episodes up to the most recent one, and then after that there will be a daily thing. I actually found someone to do Naruto. I can't believe it.
Excellent.
That's going to be one hell of a catch-up article.
Well, we're not. I told her, I was like, just forget it. Like, even the catch-up, if you did like 2 months of catch-up, it still wouldn't make sense to people who hadn't been following the damn thing.
I tried to get back into Naruto a year ago when my weekly Shonen Jump subscription started, and I was like completely lost. And then I had to look up and find out, oh, you got to go 200 chapters back for the start of this giant fight.
Preposterous. So is this new feature going to be called Anime Without Pity?
No.
Thank God.
It's not like obnoxious recaps. Like, it's basically just longer preview guide entry style analysis of new episodes, like you see on Navy Club. Like, that's pretty much the model for what we're doing.
Sure.
So they'll be on the front page every day, and we're covering like 31 shows. There's a few we didn't get in there just because absolutely no one would volunteer for them, and I couldn't even force them on people. So,
which were those?
Nobunaga Concerto, which I don't think anyone is watching that.
That's going to be one of those shows that sells like 60 DVDs when it comes out video.
Yeah, yeah. And that Fate, Ilya, whatever, Plasma, whatever that Fate spin-off.
Surprised there isn't like some hardcore, like, aficionado for that stuff who's willing to cover it, though I know they've been habitually displeased with some of the various Fate, you know, adaptations, and maybe that's just another one that fan base is rejecting. I don't know,
but you know, we did a system where, you know, we had to divvy these up. It's only one writer per show, so I you know, had everyone submit a top five, and then we divvied up the shows that way, and whatever people wouldn't take I would just assign. But even some of the stuff I assigned, they're like, look, I really don't want to do that. I'm like, okay. Okay. All right, but no one wanted that, and you know, I got some guys that are into that sort of thing, and they didn't want it. So,
so what you're saying, Zach, is someone is doing sumo asshole?
No.
Rats.
I thought about doing that. I thought about going back to spring and shows that have been running since the spring that are still.
Oh,
running.
I see what you mean. Yeah, yeah.
I thought about doing that, but those are all going to wrap up in like a month. And I don't want to have to force someone to catch up on 17 episodes of something. So right now, this is just, we're just going to do the end of summer, and then we'll start fresh in the fall right away with episode ones and twos and stuff like that. So the preview guide actually isn't changing. There might be more people contributing to it. But afterwards, then those will just roll over into daily streaming reviews. So the preview guide never ends.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what this yields, man. I'm not big into the episode-by-episode review format, but I really want to see some new voices. It's so hard to find good writers.
Sorry, it'll force people to, you know, get up to snuff just because you'll be writing something continuously. And so it's a good opportunity for a lot of people. I mean, again, I'm with Mike. I think that it's very hard to come up with something, uniquely analytical on a week-to-week basis until you've seen more. But it's what people want. I mean, AV Club is hugely successful, and I'm sure, you know, a huge portion of the anime blogging community wants that kind of content. So I look forward to it.
Yeah, well, you know, it, the way I see it, it's like if effectively we have enough anime programming four times a year to fill out a primetime television schedule. It's 32 shows, and that's not even everything. So if it's a full TV schedule, I'm going to treat it like a full TV schedule, and I'm going to hire enough writers to cover a full TV schedule, not one person covering 30 shows or whatever crazy shit we used to do. Those days are over. So I'm just going to treat it like TV, which is what it is. So, yeah. Okay, so Justin and I didn't go this year. We went last year, but not this year. But Mike and Daryl, you guys were at Otakon.
We sure were.
And, absolutely. So tell us how it was. Mike, you want to start on this one?
Well, I'm going to have kind of an incomplete picture because I got kind of sick on Friday. I was just, it felt like a hangover that wouldn't go away. It was just like an absolutely miserable sore throat and just kind of felt kind of weak and shaky. I got out of bed to do the ANN panel with Chris, but after that point, I kind of went back to bed. So I missed Mr. Katabuchi and the My My Miracle screening, much to my dismay. But what are you going to do? The thing about Otakon and about a lot of big conventions is you can miss the tentpole event you wanted to see and still have a great time. And that's exactly what happened to me. My favorite panel that I saw in the creative stuff was the Fire Emblem character designer, Mr. Kozaki. He did a live drawing panel where he basically just took requests from the audience of characters to draw and did fun things. So you had a document camera trained on his drawing arm as he draws, you know, one of the characters from Fire Emblem eating the donut cat from his webcomic, Donyatsu, and stuff like that. And also, it kind of turned in Mr. Yura, the producer of Under the Dog, that new Kickstarter, was at this panel. The panel kind of turned into a pitch for Under the Dog, which I was fine with because that meant I wouldn't have to go to the Under the Dog panel, which was happening immediately afterwards.
Interesting.
So, yeah, it was informative. You got to see some cool people. Aside from that, the other highlight, which I wasn't really expecting because this isn't my bag, was the Yoshiki Hayashi concert on Sunday.
Right. How was that?
I kind of chanced into that. Yeah, that was really interesting. He's a very talented musician and a great performer. It was a big spectacle, you know, a good sound and light show. What it was it was the tail end of his last world tour, which was for something called Yoshiki Classical. He's actually a classically trained musician. He grew up listening to classical music as a kid. So what this was him taking a bunch of ex-Japan songs and rearranging them for classical instrumentation. He had a string quartet accompanying him on piano. So a couple of the songs were kind of elevator music-y, but some of the others were really quite compelling. And, you know, one of the songs was a tribute to the band members who had famously passed away. The guitarist Hide and another band member passed away a couple of years after that. I think it was Toshi. But yeah, he gave this great monologue memorializing them and then went into the song. He had a vocalist sing with him song to the Saint Seiya CG movie, which is, I wonder how much that one cost. That's Toei's next big CG film. Mm. But it was a really cool spectacle. I was not expecting to be that compelled by it, but I had a great time. It was a really cool show.
Yeah, they push him real hard on us entertainment press folks. I used to have like a little counter. It's like how 00 days since the last press release about something that Yoshiki is doing.
Is that just the Chase Wang effect, though?
Yeah, he used to be in charge of that. I don't know that he is anymore, but man, I would just never ending press releases. Anytime that guy like bought a hamburger, I would get a press release about it.
Well, I mean, that guy's also been in LA for years, and he's a busy dude. He has like a couple of charitable trusts. He's always working on a record or touring. He used to own a recording studio there. I was going to say something else about his hype level of activity, but it just went right out of my head. Oh no, yeah, you were saying they push him a lot. The thing is, that guy has a following. Like, there were a good 400 or 500 people in that concert.
Yeah, no, I know.
Who were not anime nerds, they were ex-Japan nerds. Like, right. there were Japanese fans that flew in from Japan. There were people who came down from New York and flew over from LA to see him. Otakon was very secondary to their interests.
Yeah.
And the other thing that impressed me is that I was in that room a couple of years ago when Aya Hirano was the headliner in that concert. She drew a couple of thousand people, but she didn't fill that room. He just about did. There were a few rows of empty seats in the way back corners, like in the darkest corners of that hall. But, you know, all the main seats were full, like the secondary deeper performances in that room, those were full too. It was a good crowd. I mean, people seemed interested in what he was up to, and it was a cool show.
Cool. Yeah, I don't ever get to go to the concerts. They counter-program everything against those things, so.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's weird because it's like the big concert is either Friday night or it's on Sunday. And, yeah, I'm usually busy. I mean, it's like, yeah, you have this world famous rock and roll star, and his concert is Sunday at 1 p.m.
Yeah, that's so weird.
Yeah, they did the same thing for Yoko Kanno last year, but it keeps people coming for all 3 days, and con that big, you have to sort of space out your high traffic things, I suppose.
Yeah, that's one of many things I'll say in Otakon's favor, is that a lot of conventions, even bigger ones, on the last day of the con, the energy just kind of starts to go out of the venue. It's one of those, it goes right until 2 or 3 p.m. in the afternoon, and then suddenly it's just like, all right, time to go.
You know, I want to bring this up. Whenever I think of conventions, and whenever I think about the effect that you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
I always, in my head, have the image of the God Warrior from Nausicaa, like, kind of half getting out of the sand, and then sort of falling over. So yeah. It's like this beast that rises up, and he's almost there, and then, now that's it.
You know,
like,
you see that a lot at conventions on Sunday because the big events were all on Saturday. Everyone stayed up late partying, so it's like, yeah, Sunday is Sunday is the day to stagger over the finish line. Otakon, though, that's a different story. That's a special convention.
Well, they pack a lot into those 3 days, and obviously that's obviously intentional that they save those huge things for the last day because they know people are gonna go home otherwise.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, cool. Your panels went well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, those always go pretty well. I had some new content for all of them. The worst anime ever, that's such an easy sell. That always just instantaneously fills whatever room I put it in.
They really got to figure out that when you have a panel that's titled The Worst Anime Ever, you put that in the biggest room you can.
The biggest room, yeah, because like both that and your Craziest Deaths panel, those have been in the biggest rooms in the entire venue and just about filled them.
Yeah, and this year, you know, they bumped them down both to smaller rooms, and I mean, you had people lining up, you know, going way out into like the Skywalk, which is already, you know, kind of a congested area at that convention, and you know, just waiting to get in. And and a lot of people who wanted to for both your panel and mine, they couldn't get in. You know, it felt kind of, you know, wow, sorry guys, but that's just how it is.
Yeah, I don't have control. I mean, the 1 year I did that panel in the biggest panel room, which I think is like 1,600 people. But you know, there were some empty seats in the back and the fringes, and that made me feel really good because it was just like, okay, I know this is a popular event, but those empty seats mean that everyone who wanted to get in got in.
Yeah, I was fascinated that for this year, I mean, you know, you'd think that Kill a Kill would be like the big popular thing, and so they put both the Kill a Kill panels, mine and Charles Dunbar's, in fairly large rooms, and neither of them, you know, filled even half the rooms that they fit them in. And that was kind of fascinating to me. Like, is it just that quick that people's interests sort of drop off now that the show has ended? Because, I mean, I've done that panel at other cons, and it's been
that's
much
a big room, man. I mean, I don't know. That's a big room. Oh, and one thing I forgot to mention before is that I did get to meet Dante Basco, and I asked him about Fist of the North Star, and he didn't have too much to say about it. He said it was a cool project, it was weird and low budget, and it was a job.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. I'm sure he would have been saying the same thing about Avatar until he realized that was, you know, his meal ticket from this point forward.
Yeah, that show pushed him back into the spotlight. He drew huge crowds on both Friday and Saturday. He was a good get for the convention. And, you know, I came into the tail end of one of his panels. That's how I met him. I talked to him backstage because mine was next. And his Q&A was more like people coming up to the mic to tell him how awesome he was and to ask him for a selfie with him. And to his credit, he said yes to every single one of those. And he actually marshaled a line of people out of the room into the ante room on the side and took photos with everyone.
What a swell guy.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, Rufio and all. But no, seems like a nice guy, a happy dude doing what he loves.
Was there a lot of the bangarang going on?
A lot of bangarang?
Yeah. You know, from Hook, right? That's his thing.
Oh, yeah. 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 I mean, I guess people were shouting references to every goddamn thing that dude has done.
OK, well, you figure that's the easy one,
including The Perfect Weapon starring Jeff Speakman.
Jeff Speakman, that's right. Very important. Oh, I didn't ask him about that. I should have. But Daryl, what was your Otakon experience like now that we've heard mine?
I worked press in addition to being featured panelist, so I mean, I felt like I really saw like a fraction of the convention as well. I never even went into that first floor, into the game room, or any of that theater stuff. I didn't see any concerts. You know, missed a lot of the guests, but at least when I was in the Artist Alley, it goes to show that even the people in Artist Alley who are selling Fire Emblem merchandise were not aware that the Fire Emblem character designer was a guest of the convention. So it's not just me. There's a lot to see at that convention, I suppose.
That's interesting because the Fire Emblem guys panels that I went to, those were for a Japanese guest, which is a sad statement. They were jam packed. You know, they had hundreds and hundreds of people out to see him.
I have a pet theory as to why that is. I think people know the work and they don't know the name. And the way Otakon schedules the thing, it will just say like Sunao Katabuchi panel, and not a whole lot of people show up. You call the same panel Black Lagoon with Sunao Katabuchi. Now you got people interested. If they had called it like Fire Emblem Awakening with this person, then you'd have the big turnout. I think that's a lesson.
I agree with your pet theory 1,000%, Daryl. I think that's a great idea. I think they should mention the name of the current project of all the Japanese guests in their panel titles. Absolutely.
I've seen it work at other conventions like Anime Next. Huge turnout for when Studio Trigger was there. They called it like Inferno Cop or Kill a Kill with Studio Trigger. And then there's a big turnout because, hey, maybe people don't know who Hidenori Matsubara is, but they certainly know that, hey, maybe he worked on things like those new Evangelion movies. You know, that's how you can get people in there.
Well, you never know. Like Anime Next a couple of years ago when I went, Sayo Yamamoto was the guest, and her panel only filled about a third of the room. But then you go to her autograph line, and that thing wrapped around itself like 10 times. There were a ton of people in line to get her autograph, but like no one went to
Interesting.
That struck me as interesting.
I was interested with some of the guests I was able to interview. I mean, I did get to interview Sunao Katabuchi, who, you know, is one of these guys who's working on another new project, which we haven't mentioned yet. I guess MAPPA is working on Is it MAPPA? Yeah, In This Corner of the World.
Yeah.
Which is a new movie that they're making. It's based on the manga from the lady who wrote Town of Evening Calm. It's kind of a longer name. I'm blanking out on the full title of it and the author. But it's a fantastic. They've got a lot to show for it. Looks like it'll be a really great movie if it can get made. They mentioned they're, again, having some trouble getting the funding lined up for it. But I think you know, if the other project, Under the Dog, ends up being successful, they may look at crowdfunding that one as well. Under the Dog, I saw ads for it around the convention, but I didn't know what it was until after the convention was over. If they had said, the director of Sword of the Stranger wants to make a new anime, I'd be like, oh, sign me up. And I am, in fact, signed up for that one now. But it was just a little unclear based on the advertising and all the stuff they packed in for it. But In This Corner of the World, you know, I was really impressed with the level of research that guy put into it. Like in the artist alley, he had a little setup of like all like the little location scouting and, you know, concept drawings and the like. And this guy, like, you know, he's the kind of guy who looked like the weather patterns for certain days and certain towns to be able to, when he drew the scene, would have it right. Like looking at the train schedules so that when the train arrives, the clock in the background is correct. You know, that's the kind of detail this guy went into. And even if people didn't know that he was working on this new movie, I mean, I'm glad that a lot of people turned up for My Miracle, which, you know, is one of those things that came out years ago and then nobody licensed it for release here. And we wondered, like, hey, what happened to stuff like this and Yoni Yona Penguin and the like? And but no, it's a big turnout. You got a standing ovation at the end. I kind of wish I would have been able to see the whole thing because he talked throughout it and went into the details of how it was created and all that. Really fascinating guests as far as the Japanese side of things. I also got to talk a little bit to Shinichiro Kashiwada, who's like the big Aniplex Japan producer. And, you know, maybe my interview with that will go up in a future Otaku USA magazine. But it was just fascinating that he was, you know, a fan kind of from our generation. And he's sort of just following the trends as far as, you know, the various light novel adaptation stuff that all seem to not be for me. But, you know, they're quite well received. You know, your Sword Art Onlines and your Irregular at Magic High School, like all that kind of stuff. Ori Emo, you know, he's just looking to see like, hey, what sells? And okay, this is what the people want. All right, it's funny how they sure all seem to involve incest and Olicon. I guess that's a thing, but people demand it stay in, so I got to keep it in. You know, that's sort of his outlook.
Interesting. Yeah, I always want to ask guys in his position. It's just like, okay, so you have Sword Art Online, and it's turned into this remarkable worldwide hit. Like, how did you know? And invariably, the answer is, well, I didn't really know. It just, you know, it just happened.
Yeah, in that case, he was able to look at, well, the light novels are selling this much, and they have this demographic. That's a good pick. And he just went on down the line for that. But yeah, there was good turnout for his events as well. And yeah, I did some new panels myself, you know, some silly ones like the history of ninja in anime. We even bought the Godfrey Ho ninja headbands, the really garish ones from the 80s to wear during that panel. Very important when you're doing a ninja panel to wear Godfrey Ho headbands and not Naruto metal ones to show how serious you are.
Well, the headband has to say ninja on it. Otherwise, how will people know?
They won't know that you're a ninja. And indeed, these ones were garish headbands that had ninja written on them in big giant letters. I was very proud to have paid a dollar for them on eBay, made in Pakistan. Land of the ninja. And I also did, you know, some of the usual suspects like the, you know, Craziest Deaths, which again, lots of new stuff this year. You know, good turnout. I feel a little bad for the previous panel because, you know, I guess a lot of people kind of got seats early and stayed for mine, and so a lot of people who followed the rules and lined up couldn't actually get in. But, you know, that's the con policy, not mine. And I even, you know, had a good turnout for my Sunday 10 a.m. panel, which was, you know, the most esoteric, you know, topic imaginable. I did a sort of a thesis on what was the connection between classic old school Japanese animation and professional wrestling of the 1960s through the 1980s. And, you know, to be fair, a lot of them were getting seats early for your panel, Dubs of Time Forgot, which was in there right afterwards. But people seem to like it. One guy said he'll never go to another AWO panel again because he was shocked. But it's another badge of honor.
Seal of approval right there.
Another badge of honor.
What did you show?
It wasn't actually anything extremely lurid. It was from the 1980s during the women's wrestling boom where a lot of teenage girls were going out to see Japanese professional wrestling involving teenage girls. And, you know, there was a scene, there was an incident where one person got hurt and continued to fight on. And I sort of theorized as to why that was. And it just sort of dovetailed in nicely with the conventions of shoujo from that time, you know, from Attack Number One to Aim for the Ace on down. And, you know, just again, it is still a, you know, 19-year-old girl with her mother in the crowd, you know, whose neck just got broken, who's still fighting valiantly on. But hey, that's, you know, kind of what happens in not just shoujo manga, but, you know, sports manga at the time as well.
I was going to say, that's just Japanese fiction.
Yep, that's the connection. So that's kind of what my pet theory on it was, and seemed to be received fairly well. And I also did a Kill la Kill panel for just showing the references of things, and it's always interesting. I've done it a few times this year. I'll do it maybe one more time at Anime Week in Atlanta. And, you know, I'm getting the right audience for that, because when I show things like Project Aiko and I say, who's never seen it, and everybody raises their hands, and I'm like, okay, I've, you know, got the right people here for the panel.
That's perfect. That's so good that you expose them to that.
Yeah. And then all of them, they always, you know, they want to know, like, hey, what was that one with the ninja in it? You know, Dagger Kamui, I show some bits from that, and, you know, various old
Don't
things.
Don't do it. Don't watch that one.
I love it's a Rintaro movie. Everyone is divisive over which ones they like and which ones they don't. I freely admit that, but yeah, I like that Rintaro movie. But it, I can show like the scenes, like here's, you know, this scene from Aim for the Ace and this scene from Votoms, and here's how you put the things together to get, you know, a Kill la Kill reference. And I sort of hammer home, even if you don't know any of these references, you can still enjoy the show, and that's the sign of, you know, being put together well, as opposed to how a lot of, you know, referential things work, where it's like, if you don't know the reference, you're lost. I'm glad that Kill la Kill doesn't work that way, but it does enrich your viewing if you know these references. And so, yeah, that panel's been making the rounds each convention I go to this year, because it's the only year I get the chance to do it. But yeah, I mean, other than that, it was a lot of running around, a lot of, you know, get to this interview, get to cover this a little bit, go see this, you know, see me, at least see part of it. And, you know, there's only so much you can do, but hey, you're one guy.
I was glad,
though, that their con is a lot more laid back, you know, didn't really have nearly as much obnoxious, goofy stuff for the second year in a row, as a matter of fact. So I'm glad that maybe that's starting to wind down.
Yeah, the people yelling shit in the hallways has died way down, and that's great.
What was the crowding like?
Well, they did a lot better this time because they put up, like, some dividers and, like, the big choke points to say, like, okay, stay this side to go this way, stay that side to go that way. And little thing like that made a huge difference as far as the traffic. There was on Friday a big registration snafu on Thursday. So like a good 7,000 or 8,000 people were waiting outside until like, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, that was like a compound failure where their registration system went down and they were hopelessly optimistic and thought they could process all these people. So there were several thousand people who stayed there until very late, and then even then could not get their badge until the following day. So yeah, that was a pretty lousy situation. They recovered though. Like by Friday afternoon, that whole line was gone.
Yeah, and I never ran into like the huge logjam of humanity sort of scenarios. That might just be by virtue of where I was most of the time, mostly in the panel areas, and the really crowded stuff was elsewhere. But I mean, I checked the dealer's room, I checked Artist Alley a few times, and it never was, like, oppressively overwhelming. So I think maybe the registration cap might have helped a bit for that.
Yeah, they didn't quite hit the registration cap of 35,000, but they were right at it. They were at, like, 33,800 or something like that.
Yeah, well, I can't wait for that convention to move to a place where it can grow.
2 more years.
I love Baltimore to death, but it's so obviously outgrown that facility, and they're not expanding. I mean, if they added another wing to the convention center and renovated the First Mariner Arena like they've been promising for years, the convention probably would have stayed put. But you know, they're not doing that, so time to go to a bigger house.
Yeah, I mean, that convention could, I feel like there's nothing for it to do except grow, and it's outgrown that space so thoroughly that it's like, man, I cannot wait for you to get out of here. Because you know, you guys are like, okay, so you mentioned the policy of like, so people could grab a seat and just camp for whatever panel it is they wanted to see.
Yeah, they'd only clear if it was like going from non-18 plus to 18 plus, and I was never a fan of that policy. It's kind of like that San Diego Comic-Con Hall H thing.
Never a fan of the letting people camp?
Yeah, letting people camp. I would prefer that they would clear the rooms.
It works at Comic-Con because generally the rooms there are big enough to support it. So you're not going to have so many campers in a room that, you know, only 30 people leave and you can only let 30 people from the line in. And they program things in such a way to where if you're interested in one track of programming, you can sit in one room and get all of that programming.
That's so good.
Like, they're much smarter about it at Comic-Con, and the venue can manage it. There's enough seats to where the rooms are big enough people will cycle out. And so that's how that has to work. I feel like the Baltimore Convention Center isn't big enough for that policy to be effective, you know? I think that's where the gridlock happens. That's where you have, like, half a panel room is taken up of people just waiting for the next panel. If the room were bigger, it wouldn't be that big of a deal. So yeah, like, your space has to accommodate that, and I'm not sure Otakon can. But that's cool. I mean, you know, I went last year and I thought I did run into like a lot of the, you know, humanity log jams and thought, okay, they're gonna move to a bigger place. I'll come back when that happens. But I'm not going back to Baltimore. So
understandable.
Yeah.
It's that third floor. God, that third floor.
I still found my experiences at Otakon in terms of crowding preferable to the time I visited Anime Expo last year. It's like that con just can't seem to get crowd control down, you know?
Well, you weren't there this year.
Well, you thought that was bad last year.
Yeah.
I'm told it was much worse.
Yeah. Not only
you
do they
think that's bad.
Not only do they not have crowd control down, but they weren't expecting those extra like 30,000 people to show up.
Yeah.
So it was real bad at AX this year. So we have a bunch of Twitter questions, so why don't we get to those?
Let's do it.
All right.
Eric Barroso asks, 2014 movie opinions so far.
I can answer that in 5 words. All you need is Kill.
Yeah. That was
great movie.
Yeah,
it's been my favorite of the year so far.
My two favorites have been that and Boyhood.
I've unfortunately not been able to see, like, you know, most of the more low-key drama type stuff this year. It's mostly been blockbusters for me, and it's been a pretty good year for that stuff. I mean, the closest thing to a non-huge blockbuster I saw was The Raid 2, which I loved immensely, but it's not exactly a thinking man's movie. It's an action film, but I was glad to see that in the theater. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, I haven't seen like a movie that I've outright disliked in the theater, but part of that is due to self-selection. I mean, I think if I can say that the worst movie I've seen in theaters this year so far is Godzilla, that's a pretty good year.
I was very ho-hum on Guardians of the Galaxy. I understand why people like it, but I was just like,
I actually liked it quite a bit, but yeah, I can understand the Marvel Studios psychopaths who are really like worshiping at the church.
Yeah, people who are just trying too hard to sell that film. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed it, but I'm disappointed in it because it played it very safe, and I was hoping for a little bit more weird from James Gunn.
Well, I'm sure he wanted to make
it's a pretty weird movie if you think. Like, how many movies do you go to sit in an Eternal's head?
I really thought I'm a huge Chris Pratt fan, and I really thought that he was misused. They did not use that dude's natural charm, and he seemed kind of lost in it for especially the first half.
I don't think he seemed lost in it, but I think they didn't let him do his thing. You know,
right? Exactly.
Yeah.
Not only did they not let him do his thing, but he was also like he clearly was not used to acting with CG creatures that weren't actually there.
Right.
There were whole scenes where like he's talking to the raccoon dude and he's clearly looking in the wrong direction.
Yeah, I've said my piece on Guardians of the Galaxy. People think I hated it. I didn't hate it at all.
The second half I got into it. The first half I was just like, ugh, messy, messy, messy.
Well, it's you know, we're living in this horrible age where it's like if you give a movie 3 stars out of 4 and a big smile, or still what? Why did you hate it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing, is that you don't like it enough. I mean, I love the movie, and I'll probably see it again, almost definitely. But, you know, were there other movies that I liked more this year? Yeah, probably.
The answer is invariably, absolutely. I hate it because you identify with it.
Yeah, I've never gotten quite as much blowback as I did for just having sort of a mild opinion about it. It was like, I'd never gotten quite that much blowback just for like not liking a movie enough.
Well, guess what, Zach? Once Avengers 2 comes out, you can relive it all over again.
I think we have decided that we are largely finished with the Marvel movies. I you know, even Guardians of the Galaxy was samey to me. It tried a few weird things, and it was a little more...
That was exactly my complaint. It's, you know...
It had
to be fair, all these Marvel movies do have the same third act.
Well, like, so, Daryl, you mentioned, like, oh, there's a weird thing in there. They're inside of the head of an Eternal, which is mentioned for a second, and they show it for about 2 seconds, and it's this...
But then the inside of the set is any other space
station. Well, the best scene of the movie, when they fly into nowhere, that was awesome. That was my favorite scene in the movie.
That was
5 seconds.
Five seconds long, and the inside is just a mining colony, and you're like, all right, well, that was neat for a couple seconds. Like, it just didn't get weird, and that's the Marvel house style. They want the cosmic stuff in there, but they want it to be completely accessible to a 4-quad audience, and so it has to be really, it has to go down like oatmeal. And all those movies are basically oatmeal. That's what they've become. So, sitting there watching it, I'm kind of like, okay, you know, I'll rent these, but I don't know about like running out to the theater. And it's certainly not worth having an opinion. Like, if anything, I was taught not worth having an opinion on a Marvel movie because the fanboys are just so mad, and it's like it's not worth the stress and like all this hate coming your way. Well, don't worry.
If you want the real fanboys are so mad, you've got a Batman movie coming out next year, and that'll be where everyone's going to be real mad all over again.
Oh, fuck that shit! These
fans love being real mad about Batman.
Yeah, they sure do. Oh god! Well,
to get back to movies this year, Zach, I just saw this recently, and I remember you liking it. Tell us again, what did you think of Noah? Because I was very surprised and very impressed with that film.
That's probably my, if not my favorite film of the year, an easy number two, or tie for one, with Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yeah.
I loved Noah. I thought it was amazing.
Mythic, it's like mythic overtones, but without being like the shitty Bible movies of the 60s, you know?
The amount of convincing I had to do, it's like, it's not a Bible movie. I mean, it is, but it's not like what you're thinking. Like, not at all. It's like, just watch it. Just watch it. It's so good. Like, it's a fascinating movie. Amazing special effects that look like nothing else. Like,
yeah.
Really, really crazy, like, handmade feel, and the story is really, really good, and it doesn't feel like you're sitting in a church movie, like, ever.
Exactly. And that's part of what makes it work. Yeah, as I say, that's one of those. I got to run out and get that Blu-ray.
Yeah.
As I look at the top movies, I mean, most all of them I enjoyed quite a bit. You know, talked about the Marvel movies. Lego Movie was really good. You know, no one else here is going to go to bat for it, but it is the number one movie of the year. Transformers 4, which I loved immensely and will, you know, definitely buy because I can't get enough of immense violence on the parts of robots. You know, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, really good. Definitely my sort of thing. I'm glad I didn't see the poster because it would have given away the great moment of that movie.
That doesn't happen in the movie, though.
It doesn't happen?
Guys, no spoilers.
Okay, Mike hasn't seen it yet.
I haven't seen
the poster, so don't say nothing.
Okay.
Okay, well, what's on the poster ain't in the movie.
Okay. Maybe it's a different person or a different character, you know, in the subject. 22 Jump Street was actually really funny.
I enjoyed that.
Liam Neeson's Murder Plane, which I enjoyed immensely. Anytime it's Liam Neeson with a gun. We've got another Liam Neeson with a gun movie coming out, which I definitely need to see. Yeah. Right in between, Pierce Brosnan has a gun and Denzel Washington has a gun.
Well, man, Denzel Washington has a gun as a remake of The Equalizer.
That's right.
I expect Street Hawk and Hunter remakes next.
Well, we did in Expendables 3 just get the Airwolf Blue Thunder remake that I was dreaming of for quite a while. So, you know, it's all possible, you know, in this world where anything is coming back. I've been having a good time. You know, at least one or two movies a month I've had something to see on the blockbuster side of things. I think, you know, I'm hoping at least to go back and see the Ken Watanabe remake of Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven. I believe that's out on Blu-ray with English subtitles now, so I'm going to track that one down.
Yeah, I'd like to see that too.
I think the last two movies I saw were Neighbors, which I really liked. It's not. It's so. It's really stupid, but it's not concerned with doing anything other than make you laugh.
I fuck that.
That's fine with me. And I saw Chef, which I really liked. Justin brought that up, and I was like, I don't know about that. But then it popped up on VOD, so I snagged that, and very, very, very entertaining.
Like, it is way better than it should be, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I like a lot of Jon Favreau's earlier stuff. They tend to be really snappy. I like the way he makes his dialogue flow.
Snappy but safe.
Yeah, right. So he made it like shitty family movies for a long time and Iron Man movies that, you know, people loved. And I like those Iron Man movies, but they're not quite as snappy. And this had all of that. It had all the wit and charm and speed of his earlier films. It's a real lean movie. It just gets right to the point. It's just very entertaining and enjoyable. And when it's out on DVD here in a little bit,
Sounds like it's like Swingers, only unlike Swingers, it won't remind you of how terrible the 90s were.
I was going to throw in It's So Money and Doesn't Even Know It, but I'm glad he beat me to it.
Yeah. I couldn't deal with Swingers.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of those movies people misunderstand. It's a condemnation of those people. It's not a celebration of them.
Exactly.
I just didn't want to spend time with them.
Yeah, you're not
supposed to. I live like 2 miles from that bar.
Oh, yeah, the Dresden Room or whatever.
Yes. I brought friends there. It's like okay, I get it. The Swingers thing. Shut up, everyone.
Oh, God. Yeah. I think a better film of him is Made. And the tenor of this one reminded me a little bit of that movie. But this is sort of like his new sensibility for family sort of films combined with his older sensibility, and it worked really well. I really, really enjoyed that. So, yeah, those two. And I'm looking forward to Boyhood. I think that's on VOD, like, in a couple of weeks, so I'm going to check it out there.
Yes, Sam.
We're in the dead part of the year, so we're stuck with fucking Expendables movies.
That was good. I will hear no.
You're the only guy that didn't pirate it.
Hey, I saw the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie, and I would like to report that I saw the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. That is all.
It sure was a movie, wasn't it?
Yeah, that happened.
Even I didn't go see that one.
I got a free pass. That was about the right price for it.
All right, let's move on here. Okay, Shazari asks, do you think merchandise-driven shows are on a decline in Japan? No.
Absolutely not.
No, merchandising is one of the safest way to monetize shows in a very difficult market. That stuff's not going anywhere.
Nope. Yeah, I mean, when I go see the Wonderfest pictures, it seems like there's more stuff than ever.
Yeah, I mean, just go to Ami Ami every week, and there's a new tidal wave of Super Sonico crap every week.
Yeah, man, they're pumping that stuff out.
Yep.
Okay. This is a good question for Daryl and Mike. Invalid Name asks, any tips for first time submitting and hosting a panel at a convention?
Know what you want to do. Like, the better an outline you can present to somebody up front of here's exactly what the panel is going to be about and here's exactly how I'm going to cover it, the better they'll be convinced to approve your panel, especially at a slightly larger convention. Smaller conventions, they'll probably accept anything, but it's just, for first-time submission.
If you go to a convention under 2,000 people, they'll probably let you do whatever the heck you feel like. My take is to try and find an angle or an idea that no one else is doing, first of all. And second of all, this is very important, don't overthink it. I see so many people at these shows who show up with slide decks with hundreds of slides, and they're all nervous and jittery, and it's just like, no, man, just, you know, bring enough material to fill about 40 minutes of that hour and then just go and you'll be amazed.
Yeah. When you're hosting a panel, I think another big thing, just from a simple technical standpoint, I think you need to learn that there's an option called extended desktop on your laptops when you hook these things up. The clone desktop is you're going to lose time basically switching between your slides and your videos and all that kind of stuff. So just extend the desktop, run your presentation on one monitor, have your notes up on the monitor that only you can see. It'll help you quite a bit as far as, hitting your time marks and all that good stuff.
And, if I could say, having, sat through lots of panels, especially this year because you got to sit through the one panel to get to the next one or whatever, pick something that you're passionate enough about to where you're not just reading the Wikipedia entry about the thing. I've sat through some quote-unquote educational panels that were basically like, this sounds familiar. And they're not, and they're kind of like, they're not good public speakers, and that's okay. I can forgive that, but, like, you know, it'll be like a director appreciation, so it'll be like, oh, the films of Hideaki Anno, and it's the Wikipedia entry with a clip. And I'm like, you know, I can do this myself at home.
Yeah, I think what people want to see is some sort of perspective. I think the notion that we want to just give the objective information is patently false. You're automatically having a subjective interpretation because you're choosing to do a panel on this topic. It implies that you decide it's important enough that you want to do a panel on that topic.
Yeah.
So, yeah, don't be afraid to editorialize a bit, but support everything you got with information that's, you know, evidence-based.
Yeah,
A lot of people want to just shoot from the hip, and, you know, I think it's more worthwhile to have an editorial take on something.
I mean, this is just my personal taste. I'm not saying everybody needs to do things this way, but personally, I'm at an anime convention to have fun, and I'm not there to sit in someone's sort of fake college class. So if that's the tone you're going for, real dry, just straightforward information, not much opinion, not much personality, I'm going to be bored. And, you know, I would venture a guess that a lot of people would be bored by that, because they're at the anime convention to have fun. So make it a little fun, you know, like have some fun with it, no matter what your topic is.
Yeah, everything I do is like the stealth educational aspect. It's not like outwardly that. It's usually like, here's something silly that you'll laugh at, but I'm also picking shows that maybe you haven't seen or heard about or something like that. And you
can now
go out and see this thing yourself because it's available.
That's right. You go to Worst Anime of All Time and you're going to learn all about Knack Productions.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, you know, a good example of a guy who does this right is our buddy Chucky D, Charles Dunbar. He is very animated and is very passionate about his subjects. And while sometimes the topic can be a little dry, he himself is good at selling it. So his presentation heightens the material, and then you find yourself interested even in something maybe that's a little dry. So,
yeah, not many people can do that.
No, he's the guy, I guess. But yeah, it's tough. So pick something you're really passionate about. That was sort of my point there. Was pick something you really care about and you have a viewpoint on, and give us the viewpoint, because that's what.
And one last tip: no in-character discussion panels about asking someone. No roundtable discussions where it's like four people on there.
Beat me to it.
No good.
Beat me to it.
In-character panel discussions.
Oh
God.
The only one of those I've ever seen work was for a couple of years. They had a Hitalia World Congress at Otakon, and that wasn't four teenagers and a head table. That was a scripted event with a set in the biggest room in the house. And those kids had their shit together. But that's the only one. The only one.
Well, that's just a play.
Exactly. Exactly. It's a performance. It's not, you know, it's not some kids in cosplay shuffling up and being like, "Okay, guys, do you have any questions?
Have you read this fan fiction?" Yeah. BraxJS asks, what do you think caused the upsurge in anime con attendance this year? Was it Sailor Moon?
I don't think it was Sailor Moon, because it's not on television just yet. I think the upsurge is things like Space Dandy and Attack on Titan being in high-profile TV spots on the Cartoon Network, where lots of people are seeing them.
Yeah, anime is cool again. It's really that simple.
I wouldn't say cool. I think Sailor Moon had a little.
Hey, come on. Anime is today's hottest kind of cool.
Yeah, you're right.
Hey-o.
I do think Sailor Moon had a little something to do with it. I mean, denying the cultural impact of that and coming back after that long, like, the thirst for that shit is there. And
it's huge.
There were plenty of stories coming out of AX where a lot of people saying, like, I told my friends there was going to be Sailor Moon, and they were going to show the new Sailor Moon cast, and they suddenly wanted to go to the show. So that drew some attendance. It's not solely responsible for it, but I would put it as a bullet point on a list of the reasons anime conventions seem to be more popular this year. All the Sailor Moon stuff, because they're saturating conventions with that shit.
Yeah, absolutely. I think once TV broadcast starts up again, we'll start seeing a lot more Sailor Moon. Even then now, I mean, it's good that it's being re-released onto Hulu, and that Sailor Moon Crystal, you know, divisive as it may be, is being simulcast. So, you know, that is bringing a lot of people sort of back who were sort of lapsed, as it were.
Yeah, I'll also point out that conventions as a whole are, you know, the attendance has been swinging up pretty hard. I think people are just in the mood to go to the big nerd show and geek out. And anime conventions are, you know, they're fun. They're fun. You don't have to be that into this stuff. You can just show up and have a good time.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I'm glad to see the huge attendance growth. And I'm glad to see that the things you can obviously point to. It's not, oh, it's just a bunch of Homestucks. Because the Homestuck thing was, that seems like it's going away. But I guess he hasn't updated that comic in like a year. So
I wouldn't say it's going away exactly, but it's really flattened out. Like, yeah, the true believers are still there, but like, it wasn't what it was a couple of years ago.
Well, it wasn't what it was last year. Last year, I walked past the Homestuck gathering, the Homestuck cosplay gathering at Anime Expo, which was outside next to those food trucks. You know, that area like behind the convention center?
Yeah.
Walkway, you couldn't get through there, and they had taken over that entire giant staircase. It was a huge crowd. This year, I happened to walk past it again, and it was maybe a third the size, tops a third the size. Yeah, so I think it's it right now. It's in a lull. Who knows if it'll come back? But it's in a lull, I would say for sure.
Yeah.
So you can point to stuff like Attack on Titan and Sailor Moon and maybe Space Dandy. As, like, oh, people are coming to anime shows because they're like, yeah, I watched that. It's pretty good. Let's go to the show. You know, maybe they'll have some cool stuff or something. So that's cool. All right. Also from Brackets.js, do you think cons will ever get panel programming straight? Almost all AX panels began late. So the
that's AX's fault. That's on AX. It's not AX's fault.
It's AX's fault because what they do is they queue people in these – they have all their panel rooms in this garbage hallway that they have to block traffic. The hallways are so narrow because they put these giant curtains in that block half the hallway. So it's already a small hallway, and they block half of the space with these giant curtains in front of the panel rooms. So they have to block traffic, and it's basically one-way traffic. Only one way. And they have to block it to let people through. So they queue people in these like weird downstairs areas when the panel starts, and they usually won't even start letting people into the room until the panel is supposed to begin. So yeah, that shaves 10, 12 minutes off the top of your panel. You got 40 minutes.
Okay, so I think the issue there, what cons need to implement, all of them, is buffer time in between each panel. You know,
absolutely.
30 minutes is probably optimal. You can oftentimes get away with 15 if you've really got, you know, things going. But, yeah, I would say ideally 30-minute buffer window between each panel and have a tech person in the room. So when people walk in and need trouble, you know, or need assistance setting up their laptops and all that, they can get it.
Well,
that's pretty much the main things that'll get things started on time.
Well, here's what the thing is, that there's 15 to 20 minutes in between panels at Anime Expo, and they clear rooms. They don't let people camp. What the solution to this problem is, the minute that room is cleared, you start seating for the next panel. You don't wait until the panel start time to start letting in 500 people into a room.
Yeah.
I don't know why they push it so close, but they need to use that 15-20 minute buffer to seat.
Yeah, that was absolutely my experience when I went last year. And like, the only panels I went to that started on time were Danny Chu's panel and my panel, and that was because both of ours were the first of the day.
Yeah, right. That's when they start on time.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I know, like, the industry's very irritated with AX, especially after this year, shaving 10 minutes off their very carefully planned presentations where they had, you know, they have to cut their Q&A and some of their planned content because they lost a third of their time due to the stupid seating thing. Ugh. Anyway. All right, Redneck Otaku asks, what new series has most impressed you from the summer season so far? Daryl?
I am certainly impressed. I mean, it's hard to say that I'm impressed by Stardust Crusaders because I know exactly what's going to happen, but, you know, I'm enjoying seeing it come along. As far as something brand new that I hadn't, you know, known anything about, Tokyo Ghoul is sort of one of those sorts of shows where it's like, okay, this kind of came out of nowhere and hopefully is, you know, doing some interesting things with the idea. So, you know, it's probably toss up between one of those. I would say,
Mike, I know you're behind.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I mean, the only one I've really seen a little of is Terror and Resonance, and I'm very impressed with it.
yeah, good direction, really good music, really good animation. I just, you know, some of that writing and some of that characterization, I'm very iffy on. Hopefully it all comes together. I just, you know, I'm thinking like what happened with Eden of the East, where it's like it was a fun ride, but, you know, didn't quite stick the landing. And yeah, it makes me sort of retroactively iffy on it.
Yeah, it kind of petered out there at the end. I'm hoping that's not going to happen. I've seen the first four episodes of Terror in Resonance, and I've been very impressed so far. It's got a great sense of tension to it.
Yeah, I just wish there weren't certain scenes where it's like blatantly written in that they've made people who should know these things dumb so that they can explain it to the audience.
Oh, well, yeah. I feel like every anime now has at least a few "as you know, Bob" moments. You know,
as you know, I am your brother. Yeah.
Yes. Well, it's more like this is a world where Google and YouTube and stuff exists. And what do these people do to research questions? They go to the library and crack open a book.
Yeah.
Well, you got to have that dramatic tension.
Yeah. Japan still has CD stores.
This is true.
Yeah, for me, I guess. Yeah, I like Terror in Resonance. I'm going to wait to see how it ends to finish it or to really watch past the first episode. Because you're totally right, Daryl. I watched the first episode and said, I'm going to watch this in big chunks when it's done. Because I don't think I want to watch this in little slices. When it's done, provided everyone said, yeah, that was pretty good.
Yeah, you don't want to watch it once it comes out and it's like, that's it? What about the answers to A, B, C, D, E, F, G that we didn't get, you know, then... Yeah.
And I did watch the first episode of that Monthly Girls Nozaki-kun that everybody seems to really like. And I liked it a lot. It was very charming and funny and entertaining, and I will hopefully get around to seeing more of it. But there's a lot of chatter around how charming that show is, and they're correct. It is a charming little show. So yeah, I liked it a lot. Justin, I just assume you haven't checked anything out.
How did you know?
I know you too well. All right, moving along. Land of Obscusion asks: is there a title that you really don't like, but you keep it in your collection? To clarify, I don't mean something you like to hate. He says,
"Oh yeah, that's easy. Galaxy Angel Rune. I only have that in my collection to complete the set of Galaxy Angel anime. But yeah, that thing sucks.
Huge chunk of the CPM library. Why do I have Gall Force?
Oh boy, yeah. You know, I think you know, maybe why do I have some of the Gall Force sequels and some of the Project Echo sequels? And the answer is because I got them in a set.
You don't
and they're
have
out of Blue
Side Gray Side, do you?
I believe I do because it came in a set with a few other things when I bought them. You know, with the weird character designs and the word fit dub and all that jazz. Yeah, I mean it's something that, you know, well, it doesn't exist anymore. I don't really intend to watch it, and I don't recommend other people go track it down. And I say, just get the original movie and call it a day. But, no, I do have some of that stuff, and I can't get rid of it because, hey, it's gone, man. Someone's got to preserve this trash.
That's right.
Yeah, there's plenty of stuff that we've got on our shelves that, you know, I sort of roll my eyes at it, but... Personally, I do have a copy of Tenchi Universe TV. I will never watch
it. Oh, yeah, I have that full box set.
I will never watch it.
Holy shit.
I don't think I even want to revisit it, but I can't get rid of it. The show was formative for me, sadly enough. So there it sits as a monument to my poor choices in youth.
Oh, so it's a mistake of youth, as Shah Aznable would say.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, but there's plenty of... I mean, we have a copy of Record of Lodoss War.
even I don't own that.
Yeah, yeah. all right.
Well, do you own Record of Lodoss War TV?
No. No.
All right, so at least you have limits.
Yeah.
The only thing good about that show was the opening
credits.
Yep.
And the little SD shorts, if you want
to
count.
Yeah, the Welcome to Lodoss Island. I tend to be forgiving of Lodoss. I liked the OVAs. I loved the Dreamcast game, but that TV show, man, that was a tough watch.
All right, a person asks, what are your thoughts on Ruwubi being licensed in Japan?
I don't really have any thoughts on it until you just asked me. I mean, I'm sure it'll be released and somebody will watch it and it'll be kind of a curiosity for them and say, like, okay, this is a thing. I'm not outraged by it. I'm not mystified by it. I mean, it's got a following. It's completely not my bag. But, you know,
I've seen way worse cel-shaded stuff from Japan that has been released there. So I guess
Yeah. You can say Erda, Justin. It's okay. We were among friends.
Erda, Cat Blue Dynamite, hell, Tank SWAT.
Oh, boy, Tank SWAT.
Okay, and that stuff was that one cuts when? Deep.
Justin, what do those three have in common?
Romanov, Higa.
Romanov, goddamn Higa, that's who.
And they were made when?
5+ years ago?
More than that.
Tank SWAT's a little older than that, I think. It's like
Cat Blue Dynamite's from like the early 2000s.
Yeah, I thought it was early 2000s.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. Right.
I don't know, man.
Okay.
Anyway.
We had such high hopes for Romanov Higa after watching those Gungrave cutscenes.
Oh, God. You know, I'm happy for the Rooster Teeth guys. I'm always happy to see cartoons succeed. I just find that show difficult to watch. I think Poser is a lousy animation tool. Sure. Best I can hope for is that they use Ruibi's success to create something that I really love. But I'm not a fan of the show. I don't watch it.
I'm just curious to see if it becomes some kind of a success over there. That's all.
I think it could do. I think it could. It just might.
You know, the thing is like, you know, Justin was saying, like, well, I've seen Japanese cel-shaded stuff that looks worse. If you pay any attention to the animation on that show at all, it is probably the worst professional work, quote unquote, I've seen.
It's very difficult to watch. That's why I only made it a couple of episodes in.
The animation is beyond terrible. It is an amateur hour, but the guys making it are pros. So, you know, people like to call it like a little fan project. It ain't. Rooster Teeth is not a little fan thing. It's a huge organization. They make a lot of money.
Who calls it a little fan thing? Doesn't that company have like 40 employees?
People defending Ruibi, and they call it it's just a fan project. That's what they call it. It's not. But the animation is, to me, it's some of the worst stuff I've ever seen. So, you know, I'll be curious to see if it takes off in Japan. I don't wish death on it or anything. You know, if they do great, good for them, you know, whatever. It'll be curious to see if it does well enough for them to start, because Warner Brothers Japan licensed it also for merchandising. So it'll be interesting to see if something happens with that. But, no, I mean, you know, good on them, Godspeed and everything, but man, that show looks like,
I have a hard time imagining the notoriously xenophobic Japanese fans embracing a very, very clear and not very well-made ripoff of anime.
Depends on who they cast in it, right? I mean,
oh, that's true.
Justin, go to. I'm telling you, man, go to Pixiv, look for the fan art because there's a lot of it.
Yeah. Shit,
there's like someone, actual
doujinshi. Someone over there is watching it.
There's actual doujinshi for it, I think.
Yep.
Right. Okay.
Speaking of which, I gotta look for doujinshi from like so. There's so much doujinshi out there. I am fascinated by like the American television doujinshi.
Oh yeah. But Prairie and I have ER doujinshi.
What?
ER, and specifically ER from like the, you know, the Dr. Benton, George Clooney, Anthony Edwards era, where when the show was really damn good.
Oh, so you got like William H. Macy /
yep.
George Clooney. Oh boy.
Yep.
All those I am characters. Dying to see if there's Breaking Bad /
has to be.
Yeah, I mean the ones we have are not / but it's like, you know, it's a little gag story where it's, you know, Anthony Edwards and George Clooney's characters, nothing actually happens, but they share a couple of looks, you know.
Sounds scintillating.
That's what it's all about, man.
Sounds like my love life.
All right, let's plow through some of these. Yeah. AngelXO3 asks, with G Reco on the horizon, why hasn't there been a female main character in a Gundam series?
It's interesting. You know, I did just finally, after 4.5 years, finish up watching Gundam Unicorn, which I'll get my review on my own podcast. And we've got, you know, G Reco and Gundam The Origin starting up soon, along with, I think, there may be even more Build Fighters. I can't remember at the moment.
Yeah, I think they're making more Build Fighters.
Yeah, I believe that's correct. And I think it just sort of boils down to why isn't Shoujo, you know, as big as it's been in the past. And it's really that a lot of the ladies, you know, who would watch anime are watching, you know, the stuff ostensibly for guys because they want to be able to, you know, make their slash fiction type stuff. And
And you gotta consider the target audience too. I mean, I don't think the female audience for Gundam shows in general is that large.
It depends. I mean, you know, certainly there's Double O and Seed and, you know, Wing, of course, being the big one. But as far as people willing to,
they're into it.
Yeah, substantial amounts. But I guess from the buying model kit standpoint, you know, it's a different audience. I mean, Sunrise knows like they've got their different groups like maybe three core groups of people that are watching their Gundam shows, and they have to appease all those masters. And, you know, the audience of people that are like make or break, you know, female main character is a factor as why will or will not watch a show isn't actually that high in that demographic. And in fact, in some cases, you know, it could even be detrimental. I don't think too many people would oppose. I mean, a Turn A Gundam, the main character was a guy who looked like a lady. And, you know, that wasn't the most popular Gundam series, but it's got, you know, a bit of a following.
Yeah,
but
I mean, I think it'd be a great idea if they did that. I think it would be a great idea if they did a Gundam show with a female protagonist. But if you broaden the scope to mecha anime and giant robot anime, there's not a whole lot of that stuff with female protagonists. It's just, yeah, that's interesting to think of.
Yeah, and when there is stuff like Total Eclipse, like Mob Love Alternative, you know, things that, yes, there's a female protagonist, but, you know, they're definitely written for, like, you know, hey, guys, check this lady out sort of thing. I wouldn't be opposed to it. It's more just, you know, it's probably not on anybody's minds. It hasn't really, you know, crossed their minds over there. You know, the need for, quote, changes and, you know, representation in media, in Japanese media versus Western media are two very different things.
Okay. FF Fan asks, what do you think caused the explosive popularity of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure in the West?
It's one of those things where JoJo's has been around for a while, but yep. There was always like a caveat to it. It was always maybe a little difficult to get the DVDs, or people didn't want to get into it because the translation was off, or, hey, I hear this manga release is edited. Finally, with, you know, Stardust Crusaders and the like, it's simulcast. The translation isn't like spot on, you know, I mean, it isn't spotty translated from, you know, another language to another language. You know, the animation quality is, you know, up there, you know, voice cast, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we've got a new video game. It's just, you know, we've got a lot of new media for it coming out now, and it's coming out here at when it's new. And it's as simple as that, I think.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I think it's there's been kind of a tinderbox effect where the manga has gained some infamy through pirate scans and such, and the anime hit at just the right time and set that whole thing ablaze. And you know, the anime is good. It's very entertaining. Even those crappy initial episodes of the first series are like, nope, this is compelling. I'm going to keep watching this.
Okay. Azukari asks, what color would you be if you were on a Super Sentai team, and why?
Well, we know what color Mike would be, which would be the fat guy, right?
Yeah, exactly. Whatever color the fat guy is. I think in Jetman, my favorite one, which, you know, I've seen three episodes, which is more than other Super Sentai shows. I think the fat guy is blue in that.
I thought he was brown or yellow or something. But yeah, I'm betraying my lack of Jetman affinity, since that was like my favorite one. And it's been so long since I would imagine since he was the owl or something like that.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah. That's I remember that he was the owl more than I remember what actual color he was. But yeah, right. Whatever that guy is.
And I would be with whatever color. Usually it's black, which is the second in command, who's always like being snippy with the leader.
Justin? Nothing?
Nothing. I got nothing.
Oh, man.
Fine. I'm assigning you pink.
Pink.
Okay, fine. I can deal with that.
Well, there's never room for two fat guys on a Sentai team, so they'd have to redesign me. But I think I would go for red. I would go ahead and I would do
be
that.
The leader?
I got a lot of patience. I got a lot of passion. I'm pretty good at managing people, so.
You sure you wouldn't be the monster sending, like, you know, I mean, the villain sending the monster of the week each time to, you know, blow up Japan?
You know, I feel confident in my ability to fill either of those roles. Pretty confident. What a dumb question. All right.
I'm sorry for not engaging, but I just, my brain went elsewhere immediately.
That's okay. It's okay, Azukari. All right. Our friend Wildarms Hero asks, what Japanese stuff do you guys enjoy outside of anime, manga, and games?
I'm sure he's, you know, looking down on us for not enjoying Japanese liquor and Japanese 45-year-old single ladies. But
well, I enjoy one of those.
Okay. You know, well, we certainly just mentioned, you know, in the course of this recording, you know, live action J dramas, certainly, and, you know, some of the goofy TV shows. But yeah, I mean, there's certain films and like I'm into. It's basically, you know, it's nerd stuff. I mean, it's not like I'm watching the NHK, you know, culture out.
I've never been a Japanophile per se. But there's some stuff, like one of my favorite bands of all time is Pizzicato 5. You know, huge fan of that group. Wish I got to see them live. And lately, you know, in the past few years, as part of one of my other hobbies, I've really enjoyed seeing watching Japanese soccer. Like, both the men's and the women's team are quite good, really fun to watch. They got a good league over there. Next time I go over there, I'm definitely going to some J-League games.
Yeah, and it's no secret for me that I've, you know, spent decades following Japanese professional wrestling, which is on an upturn right now. A lot of people are, you know, getting into it right at this moment because, you know, they're doing very well over there. So those are two.
Yeah, I'm still a fan of Melt Banana and Poly Six. Those are good bands. I'm not a Japanophile guy, but I mean, every time I go there, it's fantastic. I mean, we always have a great time. And, but yeah, I mean, I don't consider myself a connoisseur of their culture. I know a lot about it just through my work, but,
you don't have a replica katana?
No, there's no slow motion video of me cutting the top off a milk carton.
So, my thing that I like to point out to people that always shocks some of them is, except for like bar food, I don't like Japanese cuisine.
What?
I'm not with you on that. I like.
I'm down for tonkats.
I said, bar food. You know, ramen. You know, fried things.
What about yakiniku?
But it's just like, yeah, a lot of the more challenging dishes I've had, it's just been like, this just seems kind of boring and antiseptic to me. I'm not into it.
I would fill a bathtub with the contents of a Japanese food court and sit in it.
I can't like Japanese style curry is. Something I can't.
Yeah, I can't deal with that. No, since I'm of Indian descent.
I was gonna say I can't live without it. Like,
oh, okay. So India versus Japan.
It's so good. Yeah. Japanese style curry is so good.
Okay, I mean, I guess I wouldn't say I dislike it, but it's not something I flip out over or ever really seek out. It's maybe I just fail to be impressed by it, by most of what I've tried. Maybe I'm not trying the right stuff.
Takoyaki.
I've had it and just meh.
What about taiyaki?
Taiyaki I haven't had, actually.
Oh, okay. That's one of my favorite things.
Yeah. I don't know, like whenever I'm out with friends or whatever, especially like work buddies, Japanese food doesn't come up because it's like, look, we're already at the anime convention, we're already working with anime, like we don't need to weeb it up quite this much.
We usually go for Korean.
Yeah, we usually go for
exactly,
Korean.
Yeah,
because that's where it's mostly made anyway.
Right. Okay. Moving on. Excuse me. So Squatchulus asks, any recent unlicensed anime movies you feel like should be picked up?
Well, we just saw from Otakon, you know, My Miracle. I don't think that's actually licensed still. I think that's one of those things that's still in limbo. I could be wrong about that, but if someone is about to release that, that's certainly a good pick.
Wasn't the Anime UK or the Anime Limited Kickstarter covering the US?
I don't remember.
I believe it does. I think Yoshihiro Watanabe, Crazy Nabe on Twitter, did say that, yeah, that license extends to the US.
That's awesome. I bid on that Kickstarter, and that bid on it. I contributed to that Kickstarter, and it wouldn't have let me if they couldn't have sent it to me.
Right. Yeah. Same.
Okay. Anything else?
Manga Entertainment used to be really good for weird movies and shit. Like, what was that? What was that Keiichi Sato movie, Daryl? Asura or Asura?
Asura. That's right.
Yeah. I want someone to release that. I want someone to release Hells, which is something I've been talking up on Twitter. These are like mid-budget, kind of interesting anime films from the past 4 or 5 years, and they're just like they've just not found an audience at all outside Japan, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to see the latest loop on the third film. It's Kashiko Ike's, about Jigen come out, but a lot of that stuff has dried up as well.
It's weird, man. It took a couple of years for Funimation to get the Steins Gate film on track. You know, those Hunter x Hunter films, we're never going to see those licensed here. I feel like there's a lot of stuff,
a lot of stuff has even been, lost. I mean, this is recent unlicensed movies he's restricting to. So, there's no need to really bring up like, hey, where's my 3.9 Blu-rays or, my original Yamato movies, et cetera. But, there's still lots of stuff that's, within the last few years. That's come out in theaters and in Japan, and they look at it here and it's like, well, it's not the TV series, the movie version this time. What do we do with this?
And the others ask, any chance Ancast will sell USB sticks with all past episodes of the podcast? That would be a big USB stick because it's 200 episodes at this point.
I think this American Life did that.
I don't think I have the kind of capital to put down to pay for something like that up front. That's maybe we could get like a, if somebody wants something like that, maybe we could get like a little donation drive going. But I was thinking coffee mugs.
How many people would want that, really? You know,
well, a lot of I get a ton of requests to make all of the old episodes available in some really easy like batch, like a lot right. because the only last 50 episodes even show up in iTunes. And everything else is on the site, and you either have to use the player or download the MP3, so you could sit there and archive it all yourself. But I get a lot of requests for people wanting the whole archive.
Interesting.
So I'm not sure I would do that. The only thing I ever really wanted to make for Ancast was coffee mugs. I still kind of intend on doing that at some point. So maybe at some point. Also asks, what's your favorite non-anime podcast? My podcast listenership has dropped precipitously in the last like 2 years.
Yeah, I don't really listen to podcasts anymore.
But my favorite anymore. the thing I listen to religiously still is Giant Bombcast. But that's kind of it.
I listen to, aside from some NPR stuff, I listen to the Femme Fatale, formerly the Answer Bitch. Mm-hmm. It's basically, if you're curious about the consumer-facing side of the entertainment business, you know, the Entertainment Weekly type stuff, this is kind of what goes on behind the scenes. And it's this really kind of nerdy but sardonic entertainment journalist who's just headed up to here with people thinking that, you know, Hollywood is all that great. So it's fun. Super gay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm listening to, non-anime, non-video game type stuff would basically be like MLW Radio and, Wrestling Observer Live, that sort of stuff. Just news as far as what's going on around the world of that.
By the way, the Chicane, the British trans DJ Chicane has an amazing music podcast called Sunsets that I'm a huge fan of. It's not just trans. It's like he spans the gamut, a whole bunch of weird stuff you never heard of.
Branko Brixen asks, any thoughts on the Under the Dog Kickstarter? Are you a backer?
I am backing it. I'm looking pretty impressed by it. It's been a while since we've seen like an OAV action blockbuster in that style, the sort of thing that was popular, once upon a time and getting anime, followed here in the United States and kind of dropped down a bit. So I'm glad that we're getting something a little more accessible. It is asking for a lot of money, more than Robotech Academy, but they've got a lot more to show for it as far as their pre-production material and the staff they've got assembled. I'm fully confident that it'll get made. As far as being this much for one episode, I heard this at the Otakon panel. It's not actually on their Kickstarter page, but they did say that for every dollar they raise on the Kickstarter, they've got external backers who will chip in 10 times that should the Kickstarter succeed. So really, if they get their $580,000, they'll eventually get maybe $5.8 million, which should be enough to make their trilogy of, OAVs, as it were.
Okay.
I'm absolutely backing it. I don't have money at the moment because of the World Cup. I've been kind of light in the wallet, but as soon as I do, and I will have it before the deadline, I'll be backing that, absolutely.
I'm a backer, and I have to say, whoever is running this Kickstarter, their heart's in the right place, but they're having a really hard time with the marketing angle of this. They don't know how to edit their own writing, so all of their text is like really kind of dense and hard to kind of a slog to get through. They've posted a ridiculous number of updates, all of them really long, and it kind of impossible to read through without getting exhausted. And I've seen it in their numbers, like they've not been able to keep the excitement going. Their numbers have really started leveling off, and right now KickTrack does not have them projected to reach their goal.
Yeah, I think that was part of what made people think that, is this thing not going to be subtitled? Because, their editing was a little unclear that, they had to later post a later update saying, yeah, there will be professional English and German subtitles on this thing. But, that's the kind of risk that they run into.
Well, that Kickstarter page is a wall of text. How that is not clear and concise on there, that's a problem.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm not a backer. I tend to avoid backing anime just because unless it is like a physical release that I can only get by doing that, like Bubblegum Crisis, then I'll back it. But just straight up funding a show, I still feel weird about that as somebody whose job it is to hire people to critique the stuff. So there's an ethical thing there. I prefer to just sort of abstain. But I'm glad this question was asked because next week, right now, we're on track. It's scheduled. We're going to have the team from Under the Dog on the show. And that's Yura, Ando, and Ishii. They'll be our first Japanese guests on the show.
Yeah, full disclosure, whenever I review something that I've backed a Kickstarter for, I say I backed this. So, you know, that is something I'm aware of as well.
So
Yura speaks English quite well, so yeah, I think that'll be interesting to listen to.
Yeah, he's gonna do the translation. It'll be a little weird because you're going to hear people talking Japanese for a while, and then you'll get the translation, but we'll give it a shot. They really wanted to come on the podcast, so I'm really happy to have them. That'll be next week's episode, provided that all goes through and everything. So,
I will say that my experience backing anime on Kickstarter pretty much extends, you know, fulfilled projects extends to Kick Heart and a film called Mizue, and those have both been great experiences. I think it's really cool that we can do this.
Yeah. Oh, I think it's great. I just personally, I'm like, I probably shouldn't just give them my money. All right, Neolcolus Cage asks, planning to go to Otakon, should I go next year or hold on for the move to Washington?
I think we kind of covered that earlier in the podcast. Really just depends on your thoughts on the congestion scenario. I think, you know, there's merit to seeing it now before it moves, because I have no idea what the new venue is going to be like, or, you know, how the vibe is going to be, et cetera. I at least know what it's like now, and I go every year at least.
Well, I'd say
go now, man. Go immediately. Are you kidding me?
This
guy could be dead in 3 years.
Is it too late to get a decent hotel room already?
No.
No.
Oh, absolutely.
It's not like Comic-Con, where the hotel block sells out within, like, you know, 20 minutes. The cheapest hotel will sell out really quick, but no, there's plenty of space.
So. Okay, because everyone was complaining about the Otakon hotel block opening like 2 days after the show, and I didn't get my rooms or whatever, so.
All that meant the Days Inn and the Holiday Inn sold out. That's all.
Okay. All right. Okay. Also asks, let's get through this as quick as we can here. Favorite, least favorite character designs or designers?
Oh, Jesus.
Wow. That is a huge topic.
Well, I'm just going to say, favorite, I still like Nobuteru Yuki's stuff. I think he's pretty good. I like, God damn it. Kota Hirano's character designs. I've always liked them. I can tell you my least favorites are Masami Obari, of course.
Oh,
and, Hisashi Hiraiya. Cannot fucking stand his same face bullshit.
Yeah, Hisashi Hiraiya has gotten better with the same face crap, but he's the name I always think of when I think bad character designer.
Yeah.
As a favorite, I'd pick Tsukasa Dokute, who was the Dirty Pair character designer. That like 80s snub nose look still really does it for me.
I think I'm going to pick my favorite character designer is probably Yutaka Minoa. You know, he's a really standout guy. He's kind of the guy who does a lot of that Yoshiaki Kawajiri character designs that everyone sort of attributes to him. But a lot of it's actually Yutaka Minoa. Least favorite, maybe he's like Tsukasa Hojo, like the guy. Not Tsukasa Hojo, Tsukasa Kotobuki. Don't kill me, internet. Tsukasa Kotobuki was like the guy who did like all those 90s anime look type of stuff. Saber Marionette, you know, KO Sentry Beast, you know, Maze, Lamine 4, you know, that stuff.
Ooh, really?
Yeah, I think I think I got that name right. I don't have Wikipedia in front of me.
No, I mean just
that,
like...
I didn't know that Kotobuki did KO Sentry Beast.
Maybe I'm wrong.
I have instant empathy for any character drawn by Yoshiki Sadamoto. I don't know what it is. It's like a sense memory or something.
Well, you don't like the pointy chin and the...
No, instant empathy.
Empathy.
Oh, empathy.
Empathy,
okay.
Thought
you said I have no empathy.
No, instant empathy.
Oh, okay.
I was wrong about KO Century Beast, at least for the OAV. It was Takahiko Ito who did those. Okay. Thank you, Anime News Network Encyclopedia.
Hey, you're welcome.
That saves us at least one. You forgot to mention, or you got this wrong comment.
There you go. I still like Yasuo Miyamatsu. I don't like some of his more recent stuff, but he's still... I still love the stuff that he did in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, Megazone 2-3 Part 2 is probably his main one, right?
Yeah, that beautiful. And I just love the kite designs, as abhorrent as some of those characters were.
Yeah, I'll throw my hat in. I dig Haruhiko Mikimoto, and I think I'd be remiss if I didn't say Akemi Takada. Definitely one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah. I also have, even though it's kind of a weird, wonky style, I really like Hiroyuki Kitazume.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, for some reason, all of his characters have bad teeth, but it's kind of cute. Like, they always have that weird incisor gap.
Yeah, that's on the opposite end of that, you know, there's Kenichi Sonoda, who's like Mr. 80s, and, you know, he's like Mr. Monotooth.
Right.
He of the Leno chin. Okay, let's wrap up with this one. Rasputin 2x4 asks, how can Ghibli get its groove back?
I'm pretty sure they're going to you know, shut down and make you know, fill the place with concrete so that all the animators can serve on in the afterlife. I don't know if they're going to get their groove back. I think they're kind of resigned to being like, all right, this is what we did. Peace, guys, and drop the mic.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to get their groove back. You know, moving to a contractor system for whatever they decide to do next, and having no clear creative leadership, that means they're kind of done as a creative force. They would need to completely reverse course, like both revive their animation unit and really throw their weight behind a couple of young creators to undo what they've done. And I don't see that happening. And that's fine. Had to end sometime, right?
Well, okay, they will never be the Ghibli that we knew again.
Yeah,
that much is obvious. But nobody else had or did what they did.
Yeah,
no other anime studio had the entire animation crew on salary. No other anime studio had like these two giant stalwarts basically driving everything behind it. You know, the closest we had was Group Tech with Gisaburo Sugi, who's had to move on.
Yeah. And the thing is, how do you get that back, you know?
Do you get that back, or do you try something new?
No, yeah. You know.
We don't have anyone of that caliber. We just don't. The whole industry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if they get their groove back, they're going to be very different from what they were before.
Yeah, they're going to have to come up with some sort of new strategy to do something. Cause that whole business model was very, you know, it's very kind of auteur driven, and unless you have a real, real true auteur who can really come up with something great consistently, that system doesn't work. You got to come up with another way.
Yeah, and it seems like a lot of the, you know, auteurs who popped up, maybe they were at Ghibli and had to go somewhere else to get their shot, or they got their shot at Ghibli and then never got the shot again.
Right.
Clearly, the answer is direct to video sequels.
That's right.
Hire Masami
Princess Mononoke 2.
The Journey Home.
Voyage to the New World. Yeah.
Porco Rosso, Fio's story.
God.
You can picture it, can't you?
The thing that bugged me about the way they announced that was they were kind of blaming it on the grosses of their latest film. When Marnie was here, they were kind of like, well, this isn't really doing what we thought it was going to do, so...
And it's not just Marnie.
Yeah.
There was also Kaguya.
Right, Kaguya didn't do well either. But
look at Kaguya. No, who in their right mind was expecting that to gross big?
But that's also another thing that I hate, where you have Princess Kaguya in Japan made like what, $30-40 million? Nope, still a bomb.
Well, here's what gets me about this. That's like Pixar having two middling films. Like they don't do well. They don't meet expectations. They still make money, but they're not lighting the world on fire. And they're like, well, I don't know if we can afford this anymore, guys. And it's like, okay, you walk into a department store in Japan and it's Ghibli shit fucking... It is a merchandise empire. It is close to like Star Wars over there, like Disney, in terms of sheer amount of merchandise available, and all that money goes to Ghibli. Or Ghibli. So to pretend like this is a money thing, I think, bugged me, because it ain't a money thing. It's a creative thing. And that kind of bugged me. But yeah, no, I think with you know, Miyazaki being serious about retiring this time, I guess. Yeah, I think that's it.
I mean, the only thing that I would, you know, like to see as far as, you know, those sort of follow-up things is that, you know, deep down there is a part of me that would like to see a manga faithful version of Nausicaa that just sort of told it all,
yeah,
you know,
have to
across multiple parts.
That would have to be like a TV show or a series of movies, but yeah.
Yeah, a series of films or something like that.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing that, but it's probably never going to happen.
Yeah.
It's. Well. I would say that it's sad, but what a run. Like.
Yeah, I mean,
I
don't feel like if they closed up shop and never made another movie again, it's like, oh, we didn't get to see, you know, what could have been. I think we've gotten that, you know, full body of work, effectively.
Yeah, definitely. Especially in Miyazaki's case.
Yeah.
Know, The Wind Rises is such a confident period at the end of his sentence that it's like, damn.
I can't wait for that Blu-ray.
Yeah,
I am
forward to that. I
drooling in anticipation.
I want to see it again, especially after talking to you about it. Okay, guys, well, that wraps us up. Thank you so much for coming on by. It's always great to sit and chit-chat with you. We'll try and do this less than 10 months again in the future.
We'll do it at Christmas. We'll sing Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
No, no, we'll do it New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
Oh. You'll do it New Year's Eve.
That'll be the best New Year's Eve party ever.
Oh, yeah. During the party, record a podcast.
Oh, God. Okay.
At midnight, we can just start sobbing.
But midnight Eastern or midnight Pacific?
I'll get an extra 3 hours of crying. Okay, guys. Thanks. Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Mike and Daryl for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a rating or review. We would really appreciate it, and we'll see you all next week.